WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Poet Denise Levertov once wrote, "We need a new realization of the artist as translator. I'm not talking about translation from one language to another, but of the translation of experience and the translation of the reader into other worlds." Levertov has suggested that poets should listen to experience to discover the music inherent in the material they're writing about. My guest Denise Levertov has a new collection of poems titled Breathing the Water, which, like most of her books, is published by New Directions. In a Village Voice review of her new poems, they were described as having the virtues of musicality, mystery, and directness. Levertov grew up in England and moved to America with her husband after World War II. Poet Robert Creeley published her work in his Black Mountain Review in the 1950s, but it was during the war in Vietnam that she gained more widespread popularity. Many of her poems are about the horrors of the war. She also organized writers and artists in opposition to the war. Levertov teaches now at Brandeis University. Although she's taught at universities for many years, she was educated totally outside the school system and attended neither grade school nor college. Denise Levertov, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to get us started by reading a poem for us.
Sure. May I first say that I don't teach at Brandeis now. I did for 3 years.
Okay. Thanks for correcting me.
And I teach at Stanford for one quarter
each
year.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Well, this little poem, Keeping Track, is one that you had said that you liked. Keeping track. Between chores, hulling strawberries, answering letters, or between poems, returning to the mirror to see if I'm there.
I do like that poem, and I have to tell you that it reminded me of myself in a way, occasionally looking in the mirror to see if there's something I can learn about myself. What was the circumstance behind you writing the poem?
Well, I can't remember exactly. It must have been a feeling that I'd had a number of times. You know, people do sometimes ask that question, what impelled this or that poem? And sometimes one knows exactly because it was a very specific event. But sometimes it was something that had been with one for years and that suddenly crystallized into a poem, and I think it must have been the same with this one.
You were born in England and you moved to America after the war. And in a way, moving from England to America requires getting a new language if you're a writer, if you want to really write in the colloquial style that's spoken. And I know that you've always really admired the work of William Carlos Williams, whose poetry was based on a more colloquial style of speech. Did it really shake up your writing to come to America?
It did, very much. I think in the beginning, the influence of Williams really stuck out in some of my poems. I hadn't absorbed it. But Williams was a tremendous help to me in getting the hang of America and of American English. I don't really think, though, that if one looks at Williams's poems, if he's not quoting verbatim things that he had heard, that his language is all that colloquial. I mean, it has a tremendous range, and the late poems particularly are colloquial with the kind of language that goes on in one's head. There's that kind of colloquialness. They're not always colloquial, like outside, out loud language.
Did you meet him, and did he ever give you any advice?
I did meet him many times. I used to go and see him. He was a wonderful friend to me. And I wish that they had invented neat little cassette recorders at that time, or that I had had the sense to write down the many things that he said right after I had visited him. I always thought I would remember them because they were so wonderful, but I didn't, and that is lost, alas.
It's really kind of ironic that you're teaching, but you never went to school yourself. Why did your parents keep you out of school? I assume it was their decision. Children never have a say
really
in
it. It wasn't a decision.
This.
It was laissez-faire, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
It was like, you don't feel like going to school, you're not going to go?
Well, my mother had taught school. She had a teaching certificate. And my father was an Anglican priest and a scholar. And our house was full of books. And so in the beginning, it was just that the nearest school that they thought was halfway decent was a bit far for me to walk to alone. And then it just sort of went on from there, and I was reading a lot, and so I guess they kept thinking, well, we'll send her next year, and then it never happened.
Did you have any tutorial, anything like that?
Well, my mother gave me lessons, see. I did lessons every day with my mother, and I went out for French lessons, and I went to some art lessons at one time. All my lessons stopped when I was about 12, though, because I started all my daily lessons, not piano and art, but my daily ordinary lessons stopped because I started to study ballet, and I was going to 2 classes a day, and I had a long train ride to take. So I was put on my honor to read some history or some other nonfiction in the train every day, which I did. And I used to like to go to the Victoria and Albert Museum or the National Gallery and look at paintings. So, and of course, you know, books were constantly a part of my life practically from birth. But I didn't really have any formal education after about the age of 12.
You know, as much as most children complain about going to school, it does give them something in common. Did you feel like you were missing out on a shared experience?
No, I never did. I never did. I mean, I did play with other children. I played with the girl next door and a girl who lived next door at the other side, or at least at the back. And I used to pick up friends in the park, little kids that I just would encounter playing in the park, and we'd go fishing in the stream for tiddlers, bring them home in jam jars, that kind of thing. And I had another great friend closer to my age than the ones who lived next door on each side, who were older than I. We were great friends for a while. So I did have playmates, but I appreciated my freedom and solitude.
A lot of your readers first started reading your work in the 60s when you became known through some of your anti-war poems. I think that really did help spread the word about your writing.
Yes.
Before we talk about that period in your writing, I'm going to ask you to read one or two poems. Actually, there's a couple in the new book, I think, that would be good. Can you read a poem that you wrote called During a Son's Dangerous Illness?
Yes.
And this is in my guest Denise Levertov's new book of poems, which is called Breathing the Water, and it's published by New Directions Press. And we're looking for the page that the poem is on.
This poem was begun when my son was very, very ill. It was finished quite a long time after he did recover. And it has sections which are just marked off by a little sort of dot. During a son's dangerous illness, you could die before me. I've known it. Always the dreaded worst, unnatural but possible, in the play of matter and growth and fate. My sister Philippa died 12 years before I was born, the perfect laughing firstborn, a gift to be cherished as my orphaned mother had not been cherished. Suddenly, death, a baby. Cold and still. Parent, child, death ignores protocol. A sweep of its cape brushes this one or that one at random into the dust. It was not even looking. What becomes of the past if the future snaps off brittle, the present left as a jagged edge opening on nothing? Grief for the menaced world, lost rivers, poisoned lakes, all creatures perhaps to be fire-blasted off the whirling cinder we loved but not enough. The grief I'd know if I lived into your unthinkable death is a splinter of that self-same grief, infinitely smaller but the same in kind, one stretching the mind's fibers to touch eternal nothingness, the other tasting in fear the desolation of survival.
You wrote that son. You wrote that poem after your son faced a terrible illness.
He had had brain surgery. Yes.
Did you think about things like that during the war in Vietnam too? About mothers whose sons were possibly going to be killed in the war, who would, like you were fearing, possibly outlive their child, which is one of the most terrifying
awful things to think of, isn't it? Well, I suppose I must have thought of that along with other things. I don't think I thought of it in that particularly outstanding way, though. When I went to Vietnam in 1972 and visited a number of hospitals, I did see many, many injured children, children whose feet had been blown off by American fragmentation bombs, anti-personnel weapons. And I think that at that time I perhaps was more concerned about the continuing life of people that badly damaged. And I remember seeing a mother sitting beside her child's bedside, and the child was just sort of vegetabilized, you know. I think that's worse than death.
How did your poems start getting political? Because, I mean, they really weren't for a while. What was your first step into writing more political poems?
Well, I came from a politically aware family, and so I had a certain amount of political awareness from childhood. I mean, I remember my passionate feelings about the Spanish Civil War, for example. I think I wasn't able, I wasn't mature enough to be able to write about such things for a long time. It wasn't that the concern with them was something very sudden. Probably the first poem that I wrote that could have been considered a political or sort of socially engaged poem was a poem written during the trial of Eichmann.
Do you remember any of it?
Oh, I can't memorize.
You've written so many, it would be hard to do.
I can't read from memory. But during the Vietnam War, I became more politically active myself. I had some poems before that. There were from Ban the Bomb days, you know, when the movement, the peace movement, such as it was at that time, was directed against above ground testing, for example. I think that if most poets do write in some kind of reference to their daily life, one way or another, and I certainly always have. So if I was politically active, it is natural that some poems should have emerged from those experiences too.
One thing I'm sure was really exciting for poets like yourself during the war was that there was an audience for the poems. I mean, poets were reading at readings. I mean, poets were reading at demonstrations.
At demonstrations, yes.
Poets were expressing, were finding the words to express and to dramatize the ideas that so many people were sharing. And we go through so many periods in America where poets are totally marginalized and unlistened to.
Well, one of the things that was moving to me at that time that I felt very good about was letters that I would get from people who were draft resistors, who read poems of mine in prison and passed them around to each other, or sometimes people who, you know, just were active in the peace movement and wrote and said that they always put some poems of mine in their backpack when they went off to a demonstration or a civil disobedience action. I felt very good about that. And I think that if that isn't happening now, it is because there is so much apathy. I mean, I still get asked to read poems at demonstrations. I did just 2 weeks ago at Lynchburg College in Virginia. But it's horrible, actually, to read at a demonstration, you know? It's like trying to play chamber music in a stadium. It's a completely unsuitable place for poetry, really. One has to kind of bawl it out over a loudspeaker system.
Oh, sure, right.
And you're reading to a
to a mob.
A moving audience. I mean, they're, when I go to demonstrations, I don't listen very carefully to the speeches. I mill around and look for my friends and see how many people are there. And, you know, I don't think that one listens to speeches very carefully at demonstrations. They have to be speeches. And they have to perhaps even be poems. And if I'm asked, I always comply because, you know, if that's what's wanted, I will do it. But it really is a horrible experience to read it at a huge demonstration.
Can I ask you to read another poem from your new book?
Sure.
And I'm going to ask you to read Making Peace. And we'll see if we can find
okay.
the page.
Yes, this one I have this one.
Is on. And this is on page 40.
Right, I've got that.
And the new volume of poems is called Breathing the Water.
This poem, Making Peace, did start as the result of someone having called out of a darkened auditorium to me when I was sitting on a stage with some other women at a panel on women, war, and peace. One person in the audience, whom I couldn't see because it was dark down there, made the remarks with which the poem begins. Well, I've paraphrased them. And then when I thought about this statement that she had made, it really wasn't a question, the poem emerged a week or two later. Making Peace. A voice from the dark called out, "The poets must give us imagination of peace to oust the intense, familiar imagination of disaster. Peace, not only the absence of war, but peace, like a poem, is not there ahead of itself. Can't be imagined before it is made. Can't be known except in the words of its making. Grammar of justice. Syntax of mutual aid. A feeling towards it, dimly sensing a rhythm, is all we have. Until we begin to utter its metaphors, learning them as we speak. A line of peace might appear if we restructured the sentence our lives are making, revoked its reaffirmation of profit and power, questioned our needs, allowed long pauses. A cadence of peace might balance its weight on that different fulcrum. Peace, a presence, an energy field more intense than war, might pulse then, stanza by stanza, into the world. Each act of living, one of its words, each word, a vibration of light, facets of the forming crystal."
I want to ask you something about the first line in that. A voice from the dark called out, "The poets must give us imagination of peace." Maybe I'm being too literal here, but are people always telling you what the poet should be doing in terms of peace?
Well, no, I don't think that people are always telling me what a poet should be doing in terms of peace. This particular person, who actually turned out to be, although I've never met her, but I was told afterwards that it was Virginia Sapir, one of the founders of family therapy. And she was saying that we have to have this positive image of peace and that who can provide it if the poets don't. That was her idea. I don't think that this is something which many people do say, though.
My guest is poet Denise Levertov. She has a new collection of poems called Breathing the Water. We'll talk more and hear more of her poems after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet Denise Levertov is my guest. If you don't mind my asking him, I'm interested in a little bit more about your background. Your parents had such interesting backgrounds, and I wonder how their religious backgrounds affected you and affected your poem. Now, your father was a Russian-born Hasidic Jew.
Yes.
And your mother was...
My mother was Welsh.
And her father was a priest.
My mother's father was a doctor.
Oh, he was a doctor. Okay.
Yes.
Now, your father...
My father...
Was converted to...
Yes. Mm-hmm. He became a Christian when he was at the university. His father sent him to Königsberg, to the university, because in Tsarist Russia, as a Jew, he couldn't go to the university. And while he was there, he read the Gospels and became convinced that Jesus had been the Messiah. So by then he, of course, his family didn't accept that. He taught at the University of Leipzig, and after World War I, he and my mother and my sister, who had been born in Germany, came to England, and he was ordained as an Anglican priest. So by the time I was born, he was a priest of the Church of England, an Anglican priest.
Did you grow up with a lot of religion in the house? It sounds very intense.
Yes, there was a lot of religion, but it was never stuffed down my throat, and I was never sort of made to go to church. I mean, I had religious doubts at a very early age, and my parents were sorry about that, but they kind of figured that in time I would get over them. It took me a lifetime to do, but I did, at long last.
You wrote a poem about your father after he died, which I've heard about, but I haven't read. It's in none of the collections of your poems that I have, unfortunately. But in that poem, from how I understand it, you describe him right before he died, getting out of his deathbed and doing a Hasidic dance of praise.
He did. Yes.
It sounds very. It was very moving to hear
yes,
that.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it?
Do you think of yourself as religious now, or as having a religious streak in your poems?
No, I do feel that in recent years my poems have become more and more concerned with religious matters, and I am a communicant. I do consider myself a believer. I go to a church in Boston called Emmanuel Church. It's an Anglican church, Episcopalian church, and they do Bach cantatas every Sunday. It's wonderful, wonderful music. And
is there a poem that you could read from your new collection that you think expresses that?
Oh, I don't think I have a poem that actually does. The poems that are most theological probably are the ones that are about Julian of Norwich, a 15th century, 14th century, coming into the 15th century, a little bit English mystic, but those are too long to read. I could read this poem, which is one of a number of variations on themes by Rilke. This one is a little different from the others because it's variation and reflection on a theme by Rilke. And the first half of it is from a theme in Rilke's Book of Hours, Book 1, Poem 7. But then the second part is entirely mine, not Rilke's. Variations I think of as not translations, but poems which take some images and metaphors from the original. So the first part then is the variation. If just for once the swing of cause and effect would come to rest, if casual events would halt and the machine that supplies meaningless laughter ran down and my bustling senses, taking a deep breath, fell silent and left my attention free at last. Then my thought, single and multifold, could think you into itself until it filled with you to the very brim, bounding the whole flood of your boundlessness. And at that timeless moment of possession, fleeting as a smile, surrender you and let you flow back into all creation. Two, the reflection. There will never be that stillness. Within the pulse of flesh, in the dust of being, where we trudge, turning our hungry gaze this way and that, the wings of the morning brush through our blood as cloud shadows brush the land. What we desire travels with us. We must breathe time as fishes breathe water, God's flight circles us.
Does writing poems help you think? Do you crystallize a thought as you write a poem?
Well, I have always loved the saying, how do I know what I think till I see what I say? And I think that it is a sort of motto of, or should be the motto of poets. But I think there's another kind of thinking too, which is a more analytical thinking, and that when one is teaching, when one is writing prose, one is using that other kind of thought. So poetry crystallizes one's intuitions rather than one's thought through conclusions. And the conclusions with which poetry presents one are reached through a process of following through on one's intuitions.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering if you're a poet who had to overcome shyness before being able to read your poems.
Actually, no, because I had learned to read aloud, reading children's stories to my son when he was little, and I had always enjoyed doing that. So when I first was asked to read in public, I'm sure I read too fast because I was nervous, but I wasn't shy.
Do you like your poems better in the ear or on the page?
Oh, they have to be. I feel that all poetry should be heard as well as seen. It must be heard. Even if they're only heard in your mind, you still have to hear them with your mind's ear, speak them with your mind's tongue.
I want to thank you very much for reading some of your poems
thank
for us
you,
and
Terry.
Talking
thank
with
you.
Us about your life. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been poet Denise Levertov. If you'd like to read more of her poems, she has a new collection, which is titled Breathing the Water. And like most of her books of poems, it's published by New Directions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.